heard last week by Senator Fulbright. In this, it cited Frank's position as saying that one of our prime purposes, this was put in the context of about 3 years ago when he said it, one of our goals five years ago, in our conduct of foreign policy should be to free Albania at once. And for various reasons, Senator Fulbright inserted this disparaging article. Without further ado, then, I give you Frank Johnson.
Thanks very much, Ed. I think I ought to preface my remarks by explaining to you something about how this discussion, debate, whatever you want to call it, between Dick Allen and myself originated. He and I were sitting in his office one day, and Ed Fulner was present, and before we knew it, we got into a bit of an argument between ourselves as to where this major danger lay, as between China and the USSR. And before either one of us knew it, we'd both been signed up for the Philadelphia Society. And I'd furthermore like to begin with a caveat that I hope that nobody who is here will leave this meeting with the impression that Frank Johnson, the author of No Substitute for Victory, has suddenly become an addle-pated dove who no longer knows much about communism. Certainly, the last thing I would want to do is to argue that there is no longer any danger to U.S. interests from the Soviet Union. But I have come here to present the thesis, at least, that insofar as Soviet communism is concerned, we may now be over the hump and could conceivably be coming down the other side of the hill as far as the threat of this particular brand of communism to United States interests. Most assuredly, there has been no change in the fundamental Soviet attitude or objective of achieving world communism. And a world communism, I should imagine, which would be dominated, to some degree at least, from Moscow. It was only last summer, after all, that so renowned a dove as George Ball pointed out to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that détente implies a relaxation of tension, but does not imply a fundamental change in the Soviet attitude. And when a man like George Ball can make a statement like that, I think it's fairly clear, and I think somewhat encouraging, that even those in our administration are not completely taken in by the strategy of peaceful coexistence. And certainly if we needed an acid test of the continuing Soviet purpose, it's provided to us by Vietnam at considerable expense to itself and perhaps at some risk. The Soviet Union is supporting the North Vietnamese military effort there against us. But at least for the first time, it is possible and conceivable to ask a question. And that question is, does the Soviet Union really want to see a complete communist victory in Vietnam? I think this question is very much an open one, but it can be asked for the simple reason that if there is a total communist triumph in Vietnam, it will probably be taken to be a triumph for the Chinese version of militant communism, and to that extent would impinge upon the interests of the Soviet Union in trying to establish itself against the threat or challenge of Peking to take over the world communist movement. Another very important fact that we and the Soviets must face is the strong probability that the split in the communist world is now irrevocable. There is a certain irony in this situation that for the first time there is a government which aims at the overthrow of the Soviet leadership, lock, stock, and barrel. It is not us here in the West, as many of us have long advocated that it should be. It is their friends and comrades in Peking who have made it quite clear that if there is ever to be a reconciliation between Peking and Moscow, the entire allegedly bourgeois revisionist ruling clique and the Soviet Union must be tossed into the ash can. And this, it seems to me, does impose, to a certain extent, a direct personal threat to the security of the men who now rule in Moscow, and certainly is not a condition which they can be very happy about. I would assume that what we're primarily interested in is trying to discern where the major trends for the future are. The past and the present are important, largely as they may bear upon this future trend. It seems to me that there have been four distinct phases now in the evolution of Soviet policy since World War II. The first was the Stalin period from 1945 to 1953. Very heavy-handed in their diplomacy, even ham-handed, if you will, out to get everything that was gettable as soon as possible, whether it be by subversion, coup d'etat, or direct military attack, as in Korea. And it seems probable that Stalin, at least, envisaged at that time the probability of, or at least possibility, of a fairly imminent general war with the West. He was aware of the fact that we had the monopoly of the atom bomb, and he realized perfectly well that before Russia could undertake a war against the West, it would have to neutralize that monopoly by developing its own weapon. But there's much evidence that Stalin never fully appreciated the strategic implications of nuclear weapons, and that he imagined that once the Soviets possessed it, they would cancel each other out, much as poison gas had in World War II. One rather interesting indicator of Soviet military doctrine in those days was the building program of the Sverdlov class of cruisers, 17,000-ton ships, long range, lightly armed, 6-inch guns, of which the Soviets laid down some 20 hulls during the late 40s and early 50s. Those of us who were in naval intelligence at the time were quite puzzled by this action because it seemed to make no particular military sense. No other nation was building cruisers. They had been pretty well made obsolete, except as surface raiders. And it would seem that this is the actual purpose that the Soviet naval command had in mind for them, from some further evidence that we've had from Soviet naval defectors. And surely they could not have been building commerce raiders unless they figured upon a fairly imminent general war. After Stalin died in 1953, there was a second phase, a phase of uncertainty, of reassessment, lasting into 1955. And the Soviet military strategists and political leaders, freed from the dead hand of Stalin, were able to reevaluate the new military situation and evolve a new doctrine. And I think this time they came to the conclusion that general war with the West was not at that time at any rate, was not a feasible prospect for advancing the cause of communism, because they had to reckon upon unacceptable damage to the Soviets in return. It had become clear then that nuclear weapons probably would be used in any future war. We then had the doctrine of massive retaliation, so there was no possibility of the Soviets figuring that it would be canceled out. By the time Khrushchev was fully in the saddle, in 1956, the third major period of Soviet policy began, which lasted roughly until the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. And here they evolved, essentially, this doctrine of peaceful coexistence, based upon what they claimed to be was a new correlation of forces in their favor. They said that world war was no longer inevitable because the United States would be prevented from launching one by virtue of the strategic equality and even superiority, they claimed, of Soviet military forces. And they knew at that time that they had a certain strategic jump on us in the development of the ICBM. And they planned to develop this fact to the hilt through a policy of nuclear blackmail, which was the concomitant of peaceful coexistence. In theory, we were to be deterred from intervening in peripheral areas. We were to be deterred from forcibly opposing wars of national liberation, which were legitimate types of wars. So from 1956 until 62, we had the very flamboyant Khrushchevian diplomacy. The Sverdlov cruiser building program, incidentally, was scrapped with four hulls never completed, which was a pretty good indication that Khrushchev himself had concluded that that was a poor bet. And there were certain successes for Soviet diplomacy at that time and the policy of peaceful coexistence, notably Cuba, which was not really a success per se for the Soviets because they had little to do with the initial conquest of Cuba by Castro. But there was certainly a partial success in Laos when I think it is fairly clear that the United States was deterred from intervening by the threat of a direct confrontation with Soviet power, which was then involved in that area of the world. and there was at least the partial success of the Berlin Wall in 1961. But as far as the major, the central point of Soviet policy at that time, which was the Berlin probe, which lasted for 4 years from 1958 to 1962, there was lamentably little success. The United States had a persistent refusal to give way to this alleged Soviet superiority. And by late 1960 and early 1961, our intelligence had in fact shown us that Khrushchev's claims of turning out ICBMs like sausages was so much baloney. That, in fact, the U-2 and the later reconnaissance satellites showed us that very few ICBMs had actually been put on launchers. Now, we communicated this fact, the fact that we knew the score, to the Soviets in none too subtle terms early in 1961, and said in effect to them that the game is up, boys. We know that you did not build the missiles that our own Air Force had been estimating all along that you would, and that if there is any missile gap, it is a missile gap well in our favor. So Khrushchev and company were faced with a bit of a dilemma if they were to go any further with the Berlin crisis, and if they were to make their nuclear blackmail actually pay off, they had to put up, and they had to create the missiles in fact, which they had so far claimed only in, on paper or in propaganda. So this, I think, was the essential reason why Khrushchev tried this Cuban missile gamble. He hoped overnight to create a strategic missile force in Cuba, which would again restore his bargaining position. And I can leave it to your imaginations as to what would have happened vis-a-vis Berlin if we had allowed the missiles to remain in Cuba. But since we did not, although falsely, I believe, or unnecessarily, we allowed the Soviets the satisfaction of extracting a guarantee of Castro from us in return for it, withdrawing their missiles, which was quite unnecessary. But in any event, when this major strategic gambit failed, the Soviets really had no choice but to again reassess their whole strategic doctrine and their political theories or strategy. So from 1962 until still the present time, the Soviet Union seems to be in a period of watchful waiting, a period of stalemate, a period of relative inactivity. They signed the nuclear test ban, quite possibly with the idea that it would, over the longer range, give them, again, a chance at achieving a military superiority over us. But for the moment, they are faced with a series of conditions. One is that the United States does fairly well understand the strategy of peaceful coexistence, which my friend Dick has explained so well in his book, Peace or Peaceful Coexistence. We're not under any illusions about it. It has not had the success that Khrushchev certainly hoped for when he made his famous speech of January 6, 1961. And I might say here in passing that one of the conditions for its success was that the Soviets would overtake us economically. This part of it has failed dismally. In Africa, they have achieved certainly less progress than they could have hoped for, and objectively, very little progress, really. They have very little to show for their efforts in Latin America outside of communist control of Cuba, which at the moment is a considerable liability. The United States refuses to be deterred from intervening in peripheral areas. We have now put a massive army into South Vietnam, which is entirely contrary to the Soviet established rules of peaceful coexistence. We intervened in the Dominican Republic, which is a strong indication that we are not going to take the communization of any area lying down if we are in a physical position to prevent it. And from the Soviet standpoint, there is this growing hostility of the Chinese communist regime. So what do the Soviets do now? There are a number of possibilities, of course. One of them, and many people have believed for a long time that this is the one that they will finally opt for, is to achieve world communism by the drastic step of all-out nuclear war, the surprise attack on the United States. And those who still believe that this is going to happen argue that if the Soviets are ever in a theoretical position where they could destroy perhaps 160 million Americans, whereas they would lose only 90 or 80 or 70 million Russians in return, that this would be a very tempting situation for them. They might then opt for nuclear war. Personally, I very, very much doubt this. If Dick and I have any serious or fundamental disagreement, it would be perhaps regarding his statement that for the communists, war is the least desirable method of attaining world communism. At least for the Soviet communists, I would go so far now as to say that war, nuclear war, general war, has become a totally undesirable method for proceeding. There is that one chance in a million, I suppose, that they might achieve in the future such a complete military breakthrough in the area of missile defense that they would be nearly 100% certain of stopping everything that we might send against them. But even then, my suspicion would be that they would rather employ that as a method of blackmail for compelling our peaceful surrender rather than to launch an actual attack. There is the chance that they will develop in the area of ballistic missile defense a sufficient breakthrough that they would again achieve relative strategic superiority over us, which would once more enable them to pursue the nuclear blackmail thing that they had to give up after Cuba. This is a possibility, and I hope that my good friend Bob Crane, who knows more about current developments in this area than I do, will discuss it. But these are things that we have it within our power to prevent. If we stay on our toes, if not only this administration, but future administrations, continue to deal with the Soviet Union with our eyes completely wide open, if we do not allow our military guard to fall, then we can certainly, we certainly have the basic knowledge and wherewithal to prevent the kind of military superiority that the Soviets would need to continue to pursue this policy of blackmail or that extreme improbability of actual nuclear war. So I think that if we do all these things and if our own society holds together and is not rent apart by internal dissensions, and these are all ifs, I acknowledge that, and some of them are big ifs, then at least the climate may now have been created in which this slow policy of evolution that the administration has always been talking about might begin to work, and that over a period of generations, and I think it would take that, the actual fundamental Soviet attitude would change. I see much less prospect of this happening with communist China. Still, the first generation revolutionary leaders are in control. They are old men, and they may have, as Hitler had, a certain sense of wanting to accomplish things before they pass on into the next world. This may make them dangerous as men, even though communists in general do not have this sense of imminent personal mission to accomplish things in their own lifetime. But China is in a geographical position to cause us great trouble and impose a heavy price upon us. We have declared that Southeast Asia is essential to our security. The Chinese are in a position to force us, as they have already, to put large armies into the field in Southeast Asia. The day is coming, certainly, when they will become a strong nuclear power in their own right, when they will have a strategic capability against the United States itself. Although there is some chance that they might be irrational enough to use that capability, I think even here the chances are more likely that when they have it, they will use it as a shield to deter us from attacking China. And behind that shield, they will then send the People's Liberation Army beyond China's frontiers into Southeast Asia and wherever else it might be able to reach. This, of course, supposes that Lin Piao and Mao are able to consolidate their power in the present upheavals, not a certain bet, but I think we still have to admit that it is probable that they will. And over the longer run, then, I think that China is, we are far from reaching the top of the hill with China, and that the great crises with the Chinese communists still lie ahead of us, whereas there is a good chance that the major crises, the major confrontations with the Soviet Union lie behind us. And I'll simply close my remarks by referring you to our Washington seeress, Jean Dixon. I'm certainly not an astrologer, but I think her opinions might bear here. She's been pretty accurate in some of the things she said in the past about international events. And she says that in the 1980s, there will be a great war with China, and at that time, the United States and Russia will be allies.
Thanks very much, Frank.